Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here we are in the second hour. We're halfway through an hour of open lines for your questions and your comments. Get to those phones very quickly. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, as promised. Ed is up first here. He's calling from his car. Ed, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Ed. You there?
I am.
Oh, okay. About the mosque, to me, if anybody's planning to perpetrate any crime against the nation or group of people in any sort, it doesn't matter if they're monitored from a mosque or a church or whatever. If they suspect that this is going to happen from any mosque or church, they should make sure that anybody that's giving a confession about a past crime is ruled out, that evidence should be not blocked. That person might be one of pursued to see if they're going to plan another crime. But otherwise, to prevent crime and protect our nation, sometimes there might be people will say, well, this is an infringement on our freedom. But the thing is, we're free to do what's right, not free to do what's wrong. And I don't see any problem to stop wrongdoers.
Ed, thank you very much. There's someone chiming in. So far, the listeners seem to be saying, at least on the mosque question, and we haven't had, Ed's the first one to directly address that one without me asking. You know, you got to be able to prevent these crimes. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, calling from his car. Chuck is on the line. Hi, Chuck.
How are you doing?
Very well.
You need to watch more television, Todd, so you can figure out when you can get a search warrant or a cap warrant to be able to tap into private conversations like that. Right?
Well, when can you then?
Well, you have, as long as there's a credible threat, as long as there's credible evidence that there will be a threat, then you can get a court order to be able to do that. And you don't have to inform the people that you're doing it. You can tap. But again, should we tap?
That's the question.
Well, of course, it has nothing to do with freedom of religion, because after all, whatever is, as your previous caller said, whatever is confession done in a confessional, that's certainly protected by the law, and that which is contemplated or premeditated is not. And you can tap a place of worship. Just like you can tap any other telephone or any other place of business, as long as you have credible evidence that this is about to happen.
So just to clarify the issue that you're reiterating there from the previous caller, Ed, if someone comes and says, I did this, they confess to you as a pastor, I did this, then the confidence of the confessional is in play. But if someone comes to you and say, hey, I'm planning to stab my wife, you're on the phone to the police.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's not a confession.
Right. That's an intent. That's an intent.
Yeah,
a statement
that's
of intent.
Exactly right.
All right.
Exactly right.
Chuck, let me ask you about the Nichols thing.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Why should becoming a Christian prevent a person from having the death penalty? And I would think that sometimes a person who becomes a Christian and recognizes the severity of what it is that they have done would say, let the law take its course. And might even say, you know, it would be better in this case for me to be executed. That way I could, hear from the Lord's own mouth that I have been forgiven and received into eternal life rather than having to wait out the rest of my natural days.
Thank you very much, Chuck. I mean, if I were, God forbid, to be sitting on death row and I were a Christian, I wouldn't expect it to make one bit of difference to the jury. I wouldn't expect it to make any difference. What I would expect to make a difference is my crime. And anything I did after the crime shouldn't really make any difference at all, as one of our previous callers pointed out. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Roger's up next. He's calling from his car. Roger, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well.
I guess the point I'd like to make is I wish you would perhaps qualify the question a little bit more. It almost sounds like you're asking the question whether we think it would be all right to wiretap all mosques coast to coast, and of course I think that would be ridiculous. On the other hand, what the previous caller said is absolutely correct. I mean, the laws being what they are, I believe that they can wiretap churches, mosques, if they believe that the illegal activity is being either planned or perpetrated there. So if they have probable cause, I wouldn't have a problem with it at all.
What about the mosques where it is known that some of the 9/11 terrorists frequented before their crimes? Should we be wiretapping them now?
Well, that's a tougher question, you see. I really wouldn't know what the legal ramifications would be. I don't know whether they have probable cause now. I don't know whether that's enough of an issue that it would have legal standing to wiretap.
Given that it's here's another one. Given that it is a crime to give money to organizations that would commit crimes in the United States, that would be either crimes of terrorism or whatever kind of crimes. Should we know where the money being collected in mosques is going?
Boy, you're full of tough questions. I think that if there's evidence that money being collected in mosques is going to terrorist organizations, then you have probable cause to do perhaps seek and seizure, perhaps wiretapping, in order to collect evidence. If there's no probable cause or they have no indication that that's taking place, I think that it's protected, and I don't think any judge would authorize a wiretap or a seek and seizure just on the basis that it may be going to, you know, a terrorist organization.
What? Here's the softest end of the question, okay? Should we, at the very least, be monitoring what the imams are preaching in the mosques?
Oh, well, you see, that wouldn't take any legal action whatsoever. You know, we're perfectly free to monitor what's said publicly, and I think we ought to do that. I think it's interesting to note that I think the mainstream media does not tell the full story about what's being spoken from the pulpits in mosques, and particularly those in the Middle East. I think if people were to hear that, they might have a real eye-opener of what the average Muslim thinks of the West, and Christianity in particular.
Roger, thank you very much for the call. What do the rest of you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. See, I'm picturing this scenario in which the law enforcement officials come to the judge and say, we're kind of in the catch-22, Your Honor. We have suspicions. Nothing we can put our finger on. We have suspicions that there have been communications in and out of Mosque A that might lead us someplace in our pursuit of terrorism domestically. Now, in order to know for sure, we need to monitor their phone line or their email or whatever else kind of communications we can monitor. We need to be able to monitor this stuff. So, Judge, what we're asking for you to do is allow us to do this so that we can find out whether or not our suspicions here are correct. Now, if I imagine, this is just my imagination, that catch-22 is more often than not the case when, say, the FBI is looking for permission to wiretap somebody. We got suspicions. We've seen them with this person. We're wondering what's going on here. They may lead us further in our investigation to the bad guys. Judge, grant us this. And he might say, sure. You can only listen in to certain conversations. This is a regular course of events in a wiretapping. You can listen to conversations that have this subject matter, but if the guy is calling to order pizza, you got no business listening to what kind of pizza he wants. All right? And you'll know the difference between a pizza conversation and anything else. I'm only going to allow you to listen to certain conversations. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. It's done all the time with organized crime. All the time. There's some guy, we don't know whether he's in the family or not in the family. But in order to know whether he is or isn't, we got to find out. And the only way to find out is to see who he's talking to. We want to look at his cell phone records. We want to know who he's talking to. And when he talks to so-and-so, is he just the pizza delivery boy? Or is he actually... Is he bringing in guns or drugs or illegal cigarettes or something like that along with it? Ron is calling from Town and Country. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I have a sort of 2 points. Number one, Scripture says righteousness exalt the nation. When we say to be righteous, then we're no different than the next nation a police state or whatever. But my question to you is, and I'd like you to comment on this, is at what point does a people totally forsake all freedom in the pursuit of safety? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you. Well, I don't know what at point it takes place. I don't think we've reached that point yet. I mean, I want you to think about your everyday life. I know that there's a lot of overblown rhetoric about all our freedoms are gone. No, they're not. You can still go to church where you want to. You can still say whatever you darn well please any place you want to, with the exception of maybe fire in a crowded theater when there is no fire. Now, if there is fire, you can say it. Has the government been given more latitude after September 11th to look into things, to investigate things, to incarcerate people who are not citizens or who are citizens? Have they? Of course they have. Have our freedoms been impinged upon? Of course they have. But the last time I looked out the window, we are a long ways from all our freedoms being gone. In fact, I think if you added up, I don't know how you would, but if you added it up, the vast majority of them are still very well in place. Could it get out of hand? Yes, of course it could. It could get out of hand. I'm not talking about unreasonable things. I'm not talking about 1984, everyone's being watched at every moment. I'm talking about just saying, look, there are places where a member of a terrorist cell in the United States might go. So we're going to follow him to the laundromat. We're going to follow him to the bank. We're going to find out what he's got in the bank, why he gets $10,000 a week in his bank account, where that's coming from. We're going to find out all of these things. Why should the mosque be any different? Or for that matter, if it's a Christian terrorist who plans on doing something wrong, why should his church be any different? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The other question laid on the table has to do with Terry Nichols and the life sentence he received. They were asking for the death penalty. The jury said no. One of the factors, according to the press, is his conversion to Christianity during the trial. If you were on the jury, would it have made any difference to you that he converted to Christianity? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Sarah's up next. She's waiting there in Bellefontaine. Neighbors, Sarah, welcome. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I wish everybody felt like I do about this. I would definitely have voted that he didn't get the death penalty.
So it wouldn't have made any difference to you that he converted to Christianity? I mean, not in the sense of the...
It would have made every difference to me, because I feel like, what if he really did? Look at all the people that he would have...
Would you turn down your radio, Sarah?
Oh, sure.
Please do that. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Sarah, you're back now.
Okay.
So would you have given him the death penalty or given him a life sentence?
A life sentence? I don't think. I mean, I wouldn't let him go free. But I think that if he would, he really had become born again, how many people he could have ministered to, and maybe, you know, even just one came to Christ because of him. That would have been worth it to me.
What if he would have converted to Islam in prison rather than Christianity?
Oh, no.
Then he would have gotten the death penalty.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't really believe in the death penalty. I think I still would have given him life. But when the question was asked if I, you know, would give him life for being converted, yes, I would.
Sarah, thank you very much. Sarah's the first there so far in the callers. But perhaps she's not alone. I said before, look, if I were sitting on death row for the kind of crimes that Terry Nichols has been convicted of, twice, both at the federal level and the state, the murder, the premeditated, cold-blooded murder of almost 170 people, if I were sitting on death row for that, it wouldn't make any difference. I could convert to every religion in the world, and I wouldn't expect anyone to take that into account. Now, Sarah's the first to say, well, if he converted to Christianity, look, now he's got potential as an evangelist, so we're not going to kill him. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, he could just as well have seen the error of his ways and repented to Allah and become a Muslim. Lots of people do in prison. Lots and lots of people do in prison become Muslims. Wouldn't have made any difference to Sarah. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Become a Christian? No death penalty. Become a Muslim? Let him fry. Now, that does seem a bit inconsistent, doesn't it? Would his potential as an evangelist in the prison system have made a difference to you? Now he can go and he can convert other people. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. It's open lines for your questions and your comments, your phone calls for the next 10 minutes. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We've had a lot of people now weigh in on the wiretapping of mosques. What do you think about it? Some people seem to be ambivalent. Others have no real problem with it, as long as it, of course, is. And this is assumed in the question, okay? I'm not talking about stormtroopers coming in and listening in to the other extension in the mosque. I'm talking about regular, at least on the laws as we have them now, and the Patriot Act has changed some of this a bit, loosened up the parameters. Under the laws we have now, a regular called-for wiretap, I'm sure evidence could be found for a couple mosques. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be talking with Peter Jones here in about 10 minutes about the Da Vinci Code. Ergun Kaner's interesting comments from the Southern Baptist Convention gathering last week is also coming up. Mark is calling from South County. Mark, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, Pastor Wilkin, this is Mark Sable. How you doing?
Doing well.
Good. I didn't hear the first part of the conversation about getting off the hook for becoming a Christian. Would that now include every crime I commit if I'm not a Christian? Do I get off of, you know, traffic tickets, and if I went out and robbed a bank and then said I'm a Christian, would I get out of that now,
well,
too?
Well, you know, Terry Nichols, we're talking about Terry Nichols, yeah, in this case, one of the Oklahoma City bombers, he's not getting off. He has been, at least according to the press, some of them decided, they had to have a unanimous vote for a death penalty. They were not able to reach unanimity because some of the jurors thought that his conversion to Christianity was a mitigating circumstance, at least in regard to the sentence he received. So he gets life in prison rather than the death penalty, and it seems his conversion to Christianity was a factor there.
Would he do his evangelism work in prison then?
I'm not going to try and put words in Sarah's mouth, but at least his potential to bring people to Christ would have been cut short by a death penalty, obviously.
Yeah.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, what I think is we have to pay the consequences for our sins, so the law still stands in that respect. So if the law is the death penalty, he gets the death penalty. I hope he's a Christian, then we'll meet him in heaven one day.
As do I. Mark, thank you very much for the call. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Merely asking for your opinion. Now, the Terry Nichols question is moot because chances are you won't be sitting on a jury like that anytime soon. And Terry Nichols has got his life sentence. Whether it was because of his conversion to Christianity or not, he's got his life sentence. Can't be tried again. He will live. It won't be a pleasant life, I can guarantee you, but he will live. Now, you might be sitting on a murder case. And at least from anecdotal evidence that I have from people within the legal system, it's not unusual at all for people to pull out all the stops when they're sitting when someone's being accused of murder. They'll convert to anything. Usually their lawyers will instruct them to make a rapid conversion to something quickly. Why? Because they know it is sometimes a factor. Especially in capital cases, they know it's sometimes a factor. I mean, if it weren't a factor, the lawyers would not encourage people, hey, have you ever read the Bible? You know, you might consider bringing that up. Now, these conversions sometimes are genuine. Sometimes it does take a stint in prison or perhaps even life in prison for someone to see the error of their ways. Would it be a factor for you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Some final thoughts here on consistency. This applies to everyone, including me. if you support the wiretapping of mosques and you don't see that as a serious problem for religious freedom, then I would hope that you'd also be consistent and you would support the wiretapping of Christian churches as well when it would be called for. I've heard that consistency in some of our callers. If you would give Terry Nichols a lighter sentence because of his conversion to Christianity, we should also, because we're sitting on a jury, not judging a person's faith, but judging a person's, you say, well, they repented, they see the error of their ways. Fine. You can repent in any number of ways, at least the way that the state can judge, what do they call it? Remorse. Any judge will tell you that a remorseful convict has a better chance of getting out on parole than the non-remorseful convict. So if remorse is an issue, and that's the issue that seems to mitigate between the life sentence and the death sentence, then the Muslim's remorse should be just as good. Consistency. Consistency. It also goes to the issue of credibility. We don't want to just let someone say, okay, what we don't want to do is discredit the truth of our faith by making discreditable statements. By saying, we ought to wiretap those Muslims, but man, I tell you what, if they had some suspicion of wrongdoing in our church and they tried to wiretap us, that's an infringement on our religious freedom. No, if it's not an infringement on the religious freedom of the mosque, it's not an infringement on the religious freedom of the church. And if it were illegal in the United States to make statements like homosexuality is a sin, if it were illegal, as it apparently is in Canada, and the state said, look, we have to know whether or not there are hate crimes being committed in your church, and we're going to wiretap you to find out, the Christian pastor, the Christian congregation should say, go right ahead. We will continue to speak the truth. In fact, we want you to know the truth, even if it'll land us in prison. We want you to know what we're saying. We want everyone to know what we're saying. You know, in that sense, the church really has nothing to hide as long as it's speaking the truth and acting within the bounds of the law. And even if it has to act outside the bounds of the law in order to speak the truth, still has nothing to hide from anyone, much less the world. When we come back from this break, Dr. Peter Jones will be our guest. He's a scholar in residence and adjunct professor of New Testament at Westminster Theological Seminary in Escondido, California. He's executive director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet. It's an excellent name for an organization. And co-author of the new book, Cracking Da Vinci's Code. We're going to be talking about Dan Brown's novel. You'll hear very early on in our conversation with Peter Jones from Dan Brown himself and several times throughout that conversation. I'll tell you this in advance of that hour. Peter Jones' book, Cracking Da Vinci's Code, is unique in one respect. We'll talk about it right away in the first part of our conversation. We've done a lot of hours on the Da Vinci Code. There's an insight here you want to listen for right after this break. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you ever finished reading a Bible book, but then felt frustrated because several of your questions went unanswered? Well, you'll find a helpful resource when studying the Old Testament book of Leviticus with a new Concordia commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June. You can find out more about this commentary under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Leviticus costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. How does each chapter of Leviticus find its fulfillment in Jesus Christ? And what was the purpose of the detailed instructions in the so-called divine speeches of Leviticus? Find out with a Concordia Commentary on Leviticus by Dr. John Kleinig. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The Supreme Court's recent half-hearted attempt to protect the Pledge of Allegiance highlights the need for congressional action to both protect the pledge
and rein in the courts. Missouri Congressman Todd Akin has a plan that will do just that, but it's been languishing in committee for almost a year. Steve Jordahl reports.
Uncertainty about how the Supreme Court will rule when a valid case gets to them has Congressman Akin considering adding an amendment to his bill that would ban even the high court from messing with the Pledge of Allegiance.
It's a little more controversial because we are restricting the Supreme Court, but we have Article 3, Section 2 can be used in that way and to do that.
But the Pledge Protection Act is having a hard time getting to the floor for a vote.
One of our difficult problems that we have is the head of Judiciary Committee, Mr. Sensenbrenner, doesn't really want to give the bill a hearing.
The legislation is important because the courts are hearing an increasing number of cases challenging religious expression. Eagle Forum Executive Director Lori Waters.
And this battle is being waged across the country, whether it's in the courthouses with the Ten Commandments, the Pledge, with Under God, in God We Trust, our national motto. The battle continues.
Focus on the Family legislative analyst Amanda Isaac says you could help get the bill to the House floor.
If constituents would be willing to contact the committee office, that would be wonderful, and I think we could possibly get a reaction out of Mr. Sensenbrenner.
She says keeping Under God in the pledge is a stand we must take.
It's not necessarily that our lives would change because the words were gone, but more so because of what it says about our country.
That we are indeed one nation under God. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Akin's bill has 224 co-sponsors, six more than the number of votes needed for passage. It says that no court shall have jurisdiction to hear or determine any claim that the recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance violates the First Amendment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
We know that you spend a lot of time listening to us on AM 850 KFUO, but we need to listen to you as well. To find out how to call, write, or email the staff of AM 850 KFUO, go to our website, kfuo.org, click on the contact link. There you'll find the whole staff, our phone numbers, and a way to email us. Always feel free to contact us and keep listening to AM 850 KFUO.
You can dig deep into God's Word with the new Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues Etc. book of the month for June. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section. The Concordia Commentary on Leviticus.
The only thing fictional in the Da Vinci Code is the characters and the action that takes place. All of the locations, the paintings, the ancient history, the secret documents, the rituals, all of this is factual.
That is Dan Brown, author of the best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code, making basically there, you heard it for yourself, a claim of complete truthfulness on the part of his novel, The Only Thing Fictional, the characters, everything else is true. Now, during the course of this next hour of Issues, Etc., we are going to be examining that basic claim on the part of the author of The Da Vinci Code. Are the claims made in this novel, this piece of fiction, are they fiction or are they fact? Peter Jones will be our guest. If you'd like to join us, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. We also have a live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. The best callers or emailers during this hour will receive the new book called Cracking Da Vinci's Code by our guest, Dr. Peter Jones. Dr. Peter Jones is a scholar in residence and adjunct professor of New Testament at Westminster Theological Seminary in Escondido, California. He is executive director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet and co-author of the new book, Cracking Da Vinci's Code. Dr. Jones, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
I've been fascinated to read your book. We've done many hours on the Da Vinci Code here on Issues, Etc., and I found in your book something entirely unique, and I want to begin with that. It's near the end of the book, in fact. Apart from the plot and the story, which we'll talk about here presently, you have called the Da Vinci Code an ideological call to arms. What ideology does the Da Vinci Code teach in story form?
Well, your listeners are perhaps going to understand, or they're not going to understand, because the ideology is all around us. It seems to have become almost like a politically correct ideology, and so it doesn't even sound like an ideology anymore. It sounds like common sense. But those who grew up in the 50s would perhaps remember a different kind of America, a different kind of ideology that dominated our thinking, which was much more Christian and biblical. Even if they weren't Christians, they would think about the world in terms of God as the transcendent creator, the world as separate from God, and that Christianity basically laid down the rules of ethics, morals, and that spirituality was the kind of spirituality practiced throughout the generations in the Christian church. All that has changed in the last generation, and we now live in a very different time. And the ideology that has become almost so big that we don't notice it, which Brown expresses, or rather gives expression to in a very powerful way, is what I now call neo-paganism. Now, that might be a very difficult word for some people. What I mean by that is it is a new spirituality that claims to be able to bring all the religions together and be able to employ all the spiritual techniques or technologies of all the world's religions to create a spiritual planet, a spiritual sort of culture where belief in spirituality and the divine is what counts, but you can pretty much believe anything you want to. That's the ideology that Brown, I believe, is proposing in his book in subtle and not so subtle ways, and it is in line with the way many people are thinking today.
Now coming to the plot and story of the Da Vinci Code, how in story form does Dan Brown teach this, as you said, in subtle and not so subtle ways, this neo-paganism, this idea of basically anything goes, God and nature are indistinguishable from
That's
one another.
Right.
How does the story unfold in order to teach those things?
Well, it's interesting the way he does it, and without thinking too much about it, we tended to do it in our own book. You start softly, and then you gain in intensity until at the end things become very clear. And as I say, we did that in our book, not necessarily thinking too much about it, but it so happened. Brown begins with a fascinating murder in the Louvre, and any good novel, from my way of thinking, begins with a good murder. If you like that kind of detective novel kind of thing.
Absolutely. Nothing catches the reader.
I mean, I think it happens in the first page or two, which is the way his other books begin. It's somewhat formulaic, but he is an excellent writer. I must give him those kudos. That, you know, I've lived in France. When he describes France, it smells and feels like France. He knows his subject. I've just read his book Angels and Demons, which is located in Rome, and I've been to Rome, and I've been to all the places he talks about, and he is a brilliant describer of things, so I want to raise my hat to him as a skilled writer. Well, he begins with this murder, and you follow these two people in all kinds of adventures as they begin to understand that the murder was full of symbolism, and you sort of get captured by this plot. But as the book moves on, it seems to me he begins to express more clearly a sort of a deep ideological commitment. In the middle of the book, you begin to understand that what he's doing is, maybe not in the middle, maybe more towards the beginning, it's a pretty strong anti-clerical rejection of Roman Catholicism. I don't know whether he was raised as a Roman Catholic, but as he does that, he actually undermines the biblical story and the early history of the church. So the first really strong thing he does is a very negative attack on the Bible and on the person of Christ, as Christian orthodoxy through the centuries and the ages has understood and proclaimed Christ. So that's a major attack. It comes alongside this fascinating drama that he's telling. And then towards the end of the book, he begins to put the pieces in place to propose a new kind of spirituality that I believe he has said he has become very much a believer in that spirituality and a missionary for it. So that's the overview of the book as far as I would describe it, Todd.
So we basically have a murder mystery wherein, while the crime is being solved, we are also finding out a larger mystery, being this worldwide millennia-long conspiracy on the part of the church, primarily agencies from within the Roman Catholic Church, to hide the true nature of the Christian faith.
That's right.
And to perpetuate a counterfeit to the Christian faith. What is the true nature of Christianity, according to Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code?
Well, you know, one of the fascinating things, I think, for the modern reader, is Brown's uncovering what you might call the esoteric level of history. There have always been people who have disagreed with the public discourse, the public version of the Christian West, and there have been books that have traced the rejection of the Christian worldview. I suppose you start with ancient Gnosticism, which indeed does reject orthodoxy. The Gospel of Thomas, which is a Gnostic text in its 13th saying, which is really a reworking of the confession at Caesarea Philippi, where Peter is recognized as the medium through which God reveals the truth about who is Jesus. In the Gospel of Thomas, Peter doesn't understand at all and is basically put to one side. And the more spiritual Thomas is the one who is favored. So you have this rejection of orthodoxy in the second century. And if you follow through history, you have all kinds of movements, Hermeticism, the Cathars, which are very Gnostic in their belief system. You have alchemy in the Middle Ages. You have the Rosicrucians, then the Masons. You have German Romanticism, which is very much committed to esoteric kind of thinking. And then you get to our period, and we have rediscovered this. And Brown goes to town in trying to make this, what I call the underbelly of history, the true meaning of history.
How much does the listener, if they're going to not only be intrigued by the story of the Da Vinci Code as a story, as a page-turner, virtually everyone I have spoken with says the book is a very captivating read, just in terms of keeping your attention.
Mm-hmm.
How much does the listener, if they're going to go beyond that and actually start buying into what Dan Brown is saying, and considering what he presents as initially fiction to be fact, how much do they have to buy into basically a conspiratorial framework? You said the underbelly of history. He says that's the real truth,
that's
and
right.
Everything that has been history has been a fraud perpetrated on everyone, including Christians.
That's right. Well, I think that's the problem with his preference, namely that the kind of history he wants is almost by definition secret. It's secret societies, secret codes. The particular line of esoteric thinking that he develops, of course, is the secret movement called the Holy Grail, which claims to know what happened at the earliest times and was preserved by the Priory of Zion and the Knights Templar and all the way to the present time. The problem, I think, with secrecy groups is that by very definition they are secret and therefore very difficult to know exactly what the truth is about them. I find the most one of the attractive things about Christianity is that there are no secrets, that everything is out there in the open. And Jesus predicted it. He told his disciples that they would proclaim from the rooftops. And very quickly, the Christian faith is a very public kind of expression. There are no secret societies, no secret rituals even. Baptism was practiced in the river where everyone could see. The church was wide open for non-Christians to attend, as the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians. So you are really dealing with a very different animal. And my problem with the secret societies is that it's very difficult to know, because they are committed to secrecy, exactly where the truth is.
We're talking about the Da Vinci Code with Dr. Peter Jones. He's a scholar in residence and adjunct professor of New Testament at Westminster Theological Seminary in Escondido, California. He's executive director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet and co-author of the book Cracking Da Vinci's Code. Now, you can find out more about this book on the website for Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet. Just put the acronym in with an org afterwards, CWIPP, Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet, CWIPP.org. The book is titled Cracking Da Vinci's Code. Now, to the title, Dr. Jones, and for this you have a very helpful resource in the book, actually a pullout of Da Vinci's famous Last Supper painting. Without going into too much detail, Dan Brown, the author of the Da Vinci Code, makes some pretty startling claims, not only about the Last Supper painting, but about other artwork by Da Vinci.
Without ruining the book, I will just say that the Last Supper has in it a disembodied hand clutching a dagger. It has a very famous historical character that nobody realizes is in the painting. And it has a very interesting architecture and arrangement of people around this table.
Dr. Jones, what is Dan Brown talking about? What does he reveal there, or supposedly reveal, in his novel, The Da Vinci Code, about this famous painting, The Last Supper?
Well, of course, there's where, you know, Brown is being very fictional. It doesn't prove anything about history. Leonardo da Vinci, he claims, was part of this Priory of Zion, this secret society committed to maintaining the story of the Holy Grail, or the truth, as you would say, of the Holy Grail. And so da Vinci is placing within his pictures signs that the truth claimed by the Christian church is not really true at all. Indeed, one of the interesting parts of his comment on da Vinci is to tell us why the Mona Lisa is smiling. And the Mona Lisa is smiling, according to Dan Brown, because the Mona Lisa is actually Leonardo da Vinci in drag. He's claiming, you see, that Leonardo da Vinci is actually seeking to undermine the Christian view of sexuality, and he's doing it in this coded way for those who know. So when we come to the Last Supper, he's also attempting to give this secret interpretation where what we all thought, or who we all thought, was the Apostle John is actually Mary Magdalene. And according to Brown's read of the Holy Grail mystery, it was Mary Magdalene who was supposed to be head of the church, and she was chased away by the angry macho male apostles to the south of France, where she actually took refuge. So it's a sort of an exotic part of the book, which really doesn't add much in terms of historical viability. It doesn't tell you anything about the early history of the church, since why would Leonardo da Vinci know any more than we know, really? But it's one of those exotic parts of the book where Brown can let his fictional gifts have full expression.
So he proposes to the reader, and he claims, as we heard at the very outset of our conversation, that this part of the book is not fiction, but in fact true, that Da Vinci encoded in the Last Supper painting and in other paintings hints and codes that would tell us the true nature of Christianity was a goddess religion, wherein the head would have been Mary Magdalene.
That's right.
What about this notion of Mary Magdalene and Jesus being wife and husband?
Well, again, that's probably a false statement, Todd, to call them husband and wife. More like sexual partners for spiritual rituals.
According to Dan Brown.
Yeah, but I mean, when you read how Dan Brown represents sexual rituals in the Priory of Zion, what you have is sex for enlightenment. And there's no reason, and since he actually refers to the Gospel of Philip, which is a Gnostic text probably from the 3rd or 4th century, which has this notion of holy marriage, that is, that sex in some sense is a route to enlightenment. You have to read what he says about Jesus and Mary Magdalene in that same register, which is really a radical statement, that Jesus has a sexual partner and his knowledge of the divine comes through his experience of sex with Mary Magdalene. So I want that to be quite clear, that we're not talking about a domesticated couple who go about living a normal life, having children. When you put all that Dan Brown says about spirituality and ritualistic sex, I don't think that stands up. So we have a very strange Jesus, very spiritual, but spiritual in this very cultic sense. Now, he claims, you see, that Mary and Jesus had a child. I don't think you need to say they're husband and wife. They do have a child because of what they're doing. And this child really is the Holy Grail.
So he'll take the Arthurian legend about the Holy Grail, and he will reinterpret that in order to be yet another code, yet another filter through which the truth about Christianity was being passed on.
Well, you see, with these kinds of legends and codes, you can pretty much do whatever you want to do. And there's so little, you know, public history that it's very difficult to put any controls upon the process. And Brown is really there in a field where he can just go to town and make up whatever he wants to. Now, I wouldn't say that it's absolutely incorrect that there may well have been legends about the Holy Grail. There are apparently documents that claim that the Knights Templar in the 12th century were fascinated by this business about the Holy Grail. What they meant by it is, again, you know, anybody's guess. Some people have always thought that it was the silver chalice that carried the wine at the Last Supper, which eventually, of course, was the blood of Christ. This is why the Knights Templar went on the Crusades to discover the truth about the Holy Grail. Holy Blood, Holy Grail is a is a pretty serious research work on this, though from the same point of view as Dan Brown, and indeed, Holy Blood, Holy Grail is probably the source from which Dan Brown gets most of his material, written by three Englishmen working for the BBC. That's much more historical in a sense, but even there, so much is conjecture that it's difficult, really, to say that the Holy Grail means definitely this or that.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Jones about the Da Vinci Code. He's scholar in residence and adjunct professor of New Testament at Westminster Theological Seminary in Escondido, California, executive director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet, co-author of the new book, Cracking Da Vinci's Code. Our call-in numbers, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers will receive a free copy of Cracking Da Vinci's Code, 1-800-730-2727. We also have a live in-studio email address, and that is issuesetc@kfuo.org. The best emailers as well will also receive a copy of Peter Jones' book, Cracking Da Vinci's Code, issuesetc@kfuo.org. As we go into this break, let me tell you about another great book from the Concordia Commentary series. It's the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month. This is a commentary that is not only solid in its scholarship about the book of Leviticus, answering some of those questions that will plague you when you read a book that is, for many of us, unknown and unread, but also one that is thoroughly Christ-centered and cross-focused, showing how Christ leaps off every page of the book of Leviticus. You can find out more about it by reading our Issues, Etc. book of the month. It's the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. Order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus, issuesetc.org, or that toll-free number for Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Peter Jones on the Da Vinci Code. A couple things to talk about. He mentioned there the Gnostic Gospels. What was the Gnostic heresy? What are the nature of these Gospels? How do they, in terms of history and authenticity, stack up against the canon of Scripture? You see, one of the things that if you read the Da Vinci Code and take it seriously, one of the things that you will be required to do is, well, you will be required to look at the New Testament documents, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and of course everything that follows therefrom in the New Testament. But the New Testament Gospels, you'll be forced to look at them as inauthentic, as lies, as fabrications, as yet another piece in the grand conspiracy to hide the truth from you about what Christianity is really all about. You'll have to look at them as inauthentic, their narratives as made-up stories. You'll also have to look at the teachings found therein as lies, like Jesus' divinity, and basically almost everything else about Jesus Christ in the New Testament Gospels. We're going to find out how those Gnostic Gospels stack up against the Gospels of the New Testament canon, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Dr. Peter Jones is our guest. He's executive director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet. Their website again, CWIPP.org. Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet, CWIPP.org. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.